Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
This is continuing coverage of the case against Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
We have a lot to cover here in this segment. It is the wrap-up of Day 7. And with the wrap-up of Day 7, we also have the wrap-up of not only the prosecution against Lori Vallow Daybell, but also the defense, because Lori Vallow Daybell decided to rest and not call anybody. Defense rests. Let's get into what occurred today and break all of this down for you. Let's start with the bullet, shall we? Not the gun, not the story, the bullet. Because when everything else can be manipulated, memories, motives, witness accounts, a bullet really doesn't lie. It landed where it landed. And in the case of Charles Vallow's death, the bullet told the story no one at the scene was expecting. One that didn't exactly scream self-defense. On Day 7 of the Lori Vallow Daybell Arizona trial, jurors were walked back into the Chandler, Arizona home where Charles Vallow was shot and killed. But this time, they weren't hearing theories or dramatic retellings. They were seeing photos, listening to a detective, following the cold, unblinking path of forensic evidence. And when Chandler Police Detective Nathan Duncan took the stand, he laid it out plainly. That bullet, the one found embodied or embedded in the floor directly beneath where Charles' body was found, it changed everything. It really did. Before we continue into why all of that matters, be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast right now, or if you're watching us on YouTube, press subscribe there. Please let your friends know, share this video. Please make a comment. What are your thoughts on where this case is at? I want to hear your voices. That's really important to this channel. It's not just about let's throw a bunch of content out there. And I know we put a lot of content out there. But it's about having the community and having the conversation about these cases. And we're really trying to keep the conversation sane, if you will. It's not just let's let people go crazy and insult and go nuts on each other. We're booting those people pretty quick. We're trying to have a nice, civil conversation, an intelligent conversation about all this. And we can disagree. And that is good. That's how we learn. That's how we see things from different perspectives. That's a lovely thing. So please share your thoughts in the comments. Just, you know, do it in a sensible, civil way. Where you back up what you're saying, not just calling names or saying it's a conspiracy or this or that. And there's not much of that in the Lori Vallow Daybell case, but whatever it may be, please do share your thoughts. So that bullet, let's go back to that. Here's why it matters. According to the initial story given by Lori and her brother Alex Cox, Charles had shown up angry, violent. He was allegedly attacking Lori with a baseball bat, and Alex had no choice but to intervene and shoot him twice. Yeah. The implication being it was quick, reactive, and absolutely necessary to protect Lori and tightly. But if Charles was shot while he was already down on the ground, that second shot doesn't feel like self-defense. It feels kind of like an execution. I mean, think about it. Number one, this guy wasn't the type of guy that seemed to, you know, be going after people. And if he's already down on the ground and you've stopped the threat at you, you don't keep shooting. You're not the Terminator. You've relinquished that threat. But the evidence points that Alex pointed down and finished him off. Duncan testified that the bullet's impact location suggested just that, not an angle you'd expect from a standing confrontation, not a bullet that missed its mark in the chaos. This one ended up beneath the body, suggesting Charles had already collapsed and was kneeling or prone when the final shot was fired. And if he was already down, if the threat was already neutralized, what exactly was being defended? It gets worse for the defense's narrative when you take a look at the rest of the scene. Remember the bat, the one Charles allegedly used to attack Lori and Alex? You'd expect to show some signs of contact, blood, hair, maybe even a crack or dent that it made contact with someone's skull or a hard surface in the scuffle. But the investigators recovered the bat and there was, nothing. No blood, no skin, no hair, not even a suspicious fingerprint, a smudge. Not even a smudge on the puma. Just a bat sitting there, almost like a prop that someone forgot to use. And the story from Alex, that he had been hit with the bat before shooting Charles, well, that kind of started to unravel too. No blood on the bat, no significant wounds on Alex, and no surrounding damage to furniture or walls. If there had been a truly violent scuffle, the room would have told that story, but it did not. What the room did show was a blood smear on the kitchen faucet. That caught detectives' attention because it didn't match the rest of the crime scene. There was no bloody towels nearby, no splatter, no streaks suggesting frantic wiping, just a smear like someone had turned on the water and tried to wash something off. But if there was an attempt to clean up, it wasn't thorough, and that raised even more questions. Was someone cleaning up before calling 911, or maybe just after? And if so, why? Detective Duncan made it clear that investigators didn't find any of the usual signs of cleanup. No paper towels soaked in blood, no disinfectants lying around, no bleach smell in the air. But that faucet smear stuck out like a sore thumb, like someone happened or like something happened in between the chaos and the call to police that wasn't part of the official version of events. Keep in mind that took like 40 some minutes to happen, too. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Lori Vallow-Daybell, who's representing herself in this trial, took the opportunity to cross-examine Duncan. And while her courtroom demeanor was already, it's drawn plenty of scrutiny, to say the least, this round of questioning made something clear. She was trying to poke holes in the forensic work, which is, you know, that's what defense attorneys do. But Lori. She's not a defense attorney. She asked why luminol wasn't used on the bat or the gun, basically implying that there couldn't have been blood not visible to the naked eye, trace evidence, residue that might have been cleaned or just not obvious. Duncan's response, they didn't see anything that justified using luminol. No red flags that screamed, test me. Investigators didn't feel the scene required it. Lori kept pressing, could blood be there even if no one saw it? Duncan admitted, sure, it's possible, but the question wasn't just about what's possible. It was about what the evidence showed. And in this case, It did not support the idea of a desperate, physical, dangerous struggle between Charles and Alex. No defensive wounds, no overturned furniture, no broken dishes or cracked walls. Nothing about the kitchen screamed life or death struggle. What it did suggest was something far more controlled, calm even, like someone was anticipating what was about to happen. Like the scene wasn't the product of chaos, but maybe, just maybe, the product of staging? That, of course, is for the jury to decide, but in a case where the defense hinges on self-defense, the forensic story is a problem because the evidence doesn't show a man out of control. It shows a man who may have been standing and then fell and then was shot again when he was already down. And once you see that crack in the story, it's hard to unsee it. You start looking back at that bat, the spotless weapon, the untouched sink, or the single casing, the lack of blood trail, and you start wondering if maybe the story wasn't chaotic after all. Maybe it was something much simpler and far more intentional. None of this is about proving motive, not yet. That part's coming, but what Day 7 did show was that the physical evidence, the things you can't talk away and your way out of, don't back up the original version of events. And when the jury has to decide what happened in that house, they're not just weighing what Lori and Alex said. They're weighing the bullet, the bat, the smear on the faucet. Because the one thing that never lies in a courtroom is the floor. And that bullet in the floor might just be the most honest witness they've heard so far. If the bullet in the floor told a story that the crime scene couldn't hide, the phone records told a story that Lori Vallow-Daybell never meant anyone else to read. And on Day 7 of her trial, the digital evidence part of the trial started to sound less like the ramblings of a confused woman and more like a step-by-step playbook for how to frame a murder as a religious mission. Yeah. Take a sip, everyone. And by the way, I'm recording this at 12 o'clock at night. As Lori on this day chose to wrap up her defense, I just could not come to the studio and get this thing knocked out. It was on my, I'm like, I could go to bed, but I'm like, I really want to get this out. So here we are. It started with a name, not Charles, not Alex, not Chad. The name was Ned. And according to Lori, that's who her husband Charles had become, or rather, what had allegedly taken over his body. In a series of text messages reviewed in court, Lori described her husband as being possessed by a dark spirit named Ned. Ned? Ned Ryerson? Boom! Groundhog's Day. I don't make many movie references. I'm not a movie quoter. That's one of like the three that I make. And the fact that this lines up in this trial, kind of rare. She said this with the same certainty most people reserve for saying someone has the flu. It wasn't just metaphorical. It was her reality, or at least the version she communicated to her inner circle. And the use of the name wasn't casual. Ned showed up over and over again in conversations with her brother, Alex Cox. Messages that prosecutors argue weren't just bizarre, they were strategic. Because once you start calling someone by a name that isn't theirs, you're not just playing around, you're dehumanizing them. You're shifting the frame. Charles Vallow wasn't a husband or a father anymore in those messages. He was a vessel, a shell, a threat. And if you believe that a dark entity had taken control of someone you once loved, then maybe, just maybe, you can convince yourself that eliminating them isn't a crime. It's an act of spiritual hygiene. There's a word you haven't heard before. Spiritual hygiene. But that's really what appeared to be going on here. That's what makes this case as crazy as it is. That's the argument the prosecution leaned into hard. One particular message from Lori to Alex caught the jury's attention. In it, she wrote, "It's all coming to a head this week." The date, July 9th of 2019, just 2 days before Charles was shot dead in her living room. Another message sent around the same time was even more direct. She told Alex, "Thank you for standing by me. I will be like Nephi, I am told, and so will you." Now, if you're not deep into Latter-day Saint scripture, like all of us are not, the name Nephi might just sound like another biblical figure, but in the Book of Mormon, you know, the one where the guy took the golden tablets across the United States, was persecuted for it, and, you know, made up a whole bunch of shit like magical underwear and stuff, and people still believe it to this day. It's called Mormonism. And I know people are like, "You're totally against Mormon." Like, it's, yes. I'm not against anyone's belief as long as they're healthy and doing it without doing crazy shit, but I'm sorry, it's crazy shit. Nephi is a prophet who is commanded by God, allegedly, to kill a man named Laban. Not just kill him, decapitate him. You know, God was doing Mortal Kombat shit back then. The reasoning, Laban was considered wicked, and Nephi was fulfilling a divine mission. So God said, "Finish him." And, you know, then it's, you know, all that, and then eventually the video game's made and everything's good. So when Lori told her brother, "I will be like Nephi," she's not talking about turning the other cheek, you know, like is in the actual Bible. She's invoking the justification of religious killing, you know. Jesus-y or not. Detective Nathan Duncan, the lead Chandler police investigator, admitted on the stand that he didn't initially catch the gravity of that message. He said he had to consult with members of the LDS Church to understand the crazy shit Lori was saying. Hey, what sort of crazy shit is this? Hey, here's the crazy shit we preach to our members. Oh, okay. But they're not allowed to take this out of the church, because if they take it out of the church, they're crazy. But within the confines of the church, it's all sane and great. Put on that magic underwear. You think I'm joking? Look it up. And across the board, the interpretation was the same. This wasn't some vague spiritual metaphor. It was a reference to divinity-sanctioned homicide. When the prosecution laid that out in court, they weren't just pointing to a weird text. They were drawing a straight line from Lori's religious beliefs to the death of her husband. And if you believe the prosecution, that line wasn't blurry. It was bold, underlined, and annotated. And let's talk about who she was texting. Alex Cox wasn't just Lori's brother. He was her lover. No, I'm kidding. That part is not proven or anything. Just speculated on. Because they got a weird relationship. He was the man who pulled the trigger, the one who claimed it was self-defense. But if he was receiving messages days before the shooting that framed Charles as a spiritual enemy and framed himself as the modern-day Nephi, then the idea of spontaneous reaction starts to feel a lot more like a plan. Are you still following along? I know, this is a lot. It wasn't just that Lori and Alex were talking about Charles, it was how they were talking about him, referring to him as a zombie, saying that his spirit had left his body, using phrases like, "the body is still alive," when discussing him. It's the kind of language that moves someone from being a person to being a problem. And when someone becomes a problem, it becomes easier to talk about eliminating them. During cross-examination, Lori tried to cast doubt on all of this. She leaned into familiar strategy, reframing the entire exchange as a joke. She told Alex told the court that her brother Alex had a history of being a stand-up comedian and that he often said things in jest, that maybe these texts weren't serious at all. Maybe they were just dark humor between siblings dealing with stress. But they weren't. She also pushed back on the idea that Nephi only had one story. She reminded the detective and the jury that there were multiple Nephis in Scripture and multiple stories, and that not every reference to Nephi meant violence. It was a smart tactic. It's one that we actually talked about yesterday on the show, going, she's going to say it was not about death. And a lawyerly one as well. To cast doubt on the specificity of the interpretation. If Nephi could mean anything, then maybe it meant nothing at all. But if that argument had limits, because when Detective Duncan spoke to multiple members of the LDS community, their understanding of the reference was consistent. Nephi, in the context of spiritual warfare, means the guy who did what had to be done, even if it meant killing. And that's exactly the kind of narrative Lori seems to be leaning into. What's more, Lori challenged the scope of the investigation itself. She questioned why police didn't speak to more members of her family about these texts, why they leaned so heavily on her estranged brother, Adam Cox, for context. She suggested that maybe investigators had tunnel vision. They were only talking to people who already thought she was guilty. It was an attempt to widen the lens to make it seem like the prosecution was cherry-picking evidence and interpretations. But the texts themselves were hard to argue with. They were Lori's words, Alex's replies, the dates were fixed, the messages couldn't be brushed away as hearsay or gossip. They were here in black and white, and they did not read like punchlines. Taken together, the digital trail painted a picture of intent, not in the same sense of a blueprint with times and dates and alibis, but in the broader sense of motive, of framing, of belief. Lori didn't just wake up one day and decide to call her husband Ned. She built a world where that name meant something, where it justified something, where it made the unthinkable seem necessary. And that's where prosecutors, in this case, wanted the jury to understand that Charles Vallow didn't just die. He was rebranded, stripped of his identity, and made into a villain in a story only Lori and her inner circle believed. And once that script was written, all it took was someone willing to play Nephi. But if Lori's phone laid out the blueprint, what about the benefits? Because when someone's husband dies and just days later they're making calls, filing paperwork, and trading love notes with someone new, it raises the next big question. What was really driving all of this? And what did she stand to gain? There's a moment in every trial when the air in the courtroom shifts. Not from a witness breakdown or a surprise piece of evidence, but from silence. From the moment everyone realizes that's it. That was the defense. That was all she said. On day 7 of Lori Vallow Daybell's trial, that moment arrived with a soft, almost anticlimactic announcement. Lori has chosen not to call a single witness. No expert testimony, no character references, not even a statement from herself. After days of watching the prosecution unload a digital and forensic barrage, Lori Vallow Daybell, the woman accused of orchestrating the killing of her husband, simply rested her case, just like that. But before the courtroom hit that stillness, the day had already been building to a deeper revelation, motive, because now that the jury had heard how Charles Vallow died and how Lori allegedly talked about him in the weeks before his death, it was time to hear what G stood to gain. And the prosecution came armed with emails, bank details, and love letters. Lots of love letters. What do you got here? It turns out, while Charles was still alive, Lori had already mentally moved on. The man she was actually pouring her emotional energy to wasn't her husband. It was dreamy Chad Daybell. They weren't just texting. They were building a fantasy world together. Not metaphorically, but literally. Emails were presented in court showing Lori had created a fake identity named Karen Walker so she could communicate with Chad in secret, even going as far as impersonating Charles in messages to Chad as his wife Tammy. One of the emails written in April of 2019 and presented by the prosecution invited Chad to Houston under the guise of working on a religious book project. It was friendly, formal, and signed by Charles Vallow, except Charles never wrote it. Lori did. Charles eventually found out that this digital masquerade, he wasn't just betrayed, he was furious. And with that discovery came the unraveling of whatever peace was left in that marriage. He confronted Chad. He reached out to Chad's wife. And somewhere in the mix, he made a decision that he may have saved $1 million from landing in the wrong hands. He changed the beneficiary of his life insurance policy. Yeah. The amount was no small thing, $1 million. Initially, Lori was the sole beneficiary, but after uncovering her affair with Chad and the extent of her deception, Charles took her off the policy and named his sister, Kay Woodcock, as the recipient. The switch, as simple as a form might make it seem, ended up being a critical turning point because Lori, she didn't take that well. Jurors were shown Lori's reaction in real time, a text she sent days after Charles' death, where she wrote, "It was not a spear, it was a spear through my heart. Not because Charles was dead, not because her children lost their father, but because she found out the money was going elsewhere." That's not just a window into motive. That's kind of a neon sign. It wasn't just the life insurance either. The very next day after Charles was killed, Lori was making moves at the Social Security office. According to testimony from Detective Nathan Duncan, she was looking into survivor benefits for Charles' children, benefits that she, as their legal guardian, would control. You don't get the life insurance, so let's go to the state. Think about that. One day after a man is shot to death in her living room, she's at the government office looking to secure monthly checks. Efficient, sure, but also telling. The prosecution didn't need to say it. Everyone in the courtroom understood the implication. And while all of this was happening, while Charles' body was barely cold, while the police were still asking questions, Lori was on the phone, not with her family, not with the police. Chad Daybell. Phone records showed a series of long calls between the two that same day. One for over 30 minutes, another one shortly after, another that night, and whatever needed to be discussed, it apparently just could not wait. And it wasn't just logistics. It was intimacy, romance, passion that played out in cringe-inducing text messages. Read aloud in court, Lori and Chad had nicknamed each other James and Elena. Not pet names. Charles, or characters rather, in some bizarre end times fantasy saga they'd created together. And we've dramatically read this on the air I don't know how many times now. Look it up on the channel, the James and Elena. dramatic readings. I've done dramatic readings with Stacy on this, with Carol on this. It's, yeah, it's insane. But if you're looking for something to listen to, it's interesting. Chad even sent Lori a story. Yes, a story starring their fictional counterparts in it, where James and Elena were spiritual warriors bonded for eternity, destined to usher in that new world. It kind of read like a religious fanatic with a body count. One message between them described being cheek to cheek, loin to loin. Another referenced being sealed together for all of eternity. It wasn't lust. It was theology. Their own twisted gospel of love and annihilation. And with Charles out of the way, the path was clear. And that path, well, it led straight to Hawaii. And loin fire. It sounds insane. I know. It sounds insane. But in those text messages, Chad Daybell texts her about the rare occurrence. Such a rare thing to happen between someone. Loin fire. That's the term he used. Use that on your next date. And the path led straight to Hawaii, because just 4 months after Charles' death, Lori and Chad got married on a beach in Kauai. The prosecution presented their wedding certificate in court dated November 5th of 2019. It wasn't just a new beginning. It was a paper trail, a reminder that Lori didn't stay grieving very long. And the James and Elena saga had moved into real life. And as prosecutors framed it, that wasn't a coincidence. It was the goal, really, all along. So by the time the prosecution rested, they had painted a picture not just of a crime, but of a motive so clear it was practically typed out in iCloud. A husband removed, money redirected, a new man waiting in the wings, and a paper trail that started long before Charles' death and continued through the tropical honeymoon. And then, nothing. When it came time for Lori to present her defense, all eyes were on her. Would she testify? Would she call a witness? Would someone show up to say this had all been taken out of context, that Lori was misunderstood, that the texts were jokes or scripture or satire? But no one did. Instead, Lori quietly informed the court she would not be calling any witnesses. Yeah. Not even herself. She rested her case. That offering the jury any alternative versions of events. No rebuttal to the bullet in the floor. No explanation for be like Nephi. No denial of the insurance fallout. No framing of the text with Chad. Just silence. It was a choice, a strategic one maybe, or maybe just resignation. But the effect in the room was undeniable. The prosecution had unloaded a mountain of evidence, photos, text, testimony, timelines, and Lori responding with nothing. No counter story, no emotional plea, no explanation for how a husband ends up dead, a bank account ends up dry, and a wedding dress ends up packed for Kauai in less than 120 days. It left the jury with one voice in their head, the prosecution's, and maybe that was the most telling story of all. It's not new. This is exactly what happened in her first trial. The defense of Lori rested right out of the gate. I was expecting more from Lori, honestly. What were you expecting? I don't know that she went into this thing trying to prove her innocence, though, either. I really wonder if she went into this thing just trying to settle scores. Trying to tell off that woman that went on a date with Charles the day before she killed him. How dare her. I don't know what she was going into this with at the end of the day. Was really expecting more. And I'm honestly a little bit disappointed that it's ending so early. But the judge has left it open to her. So while we're saying this now, well, we got a whole holiday weekend ahead of us. And when it comes back Monday, well, that may be it. Or Lori may say, I changed my mind. They're giving her all the leeway in the world not to hang herself. But Lori just seems to find a way to keep tightening that noose. And maybe that's a good thing. What are your thoughts? Tell me in the comments, wherever you are watching this on YouTube. Tell us there if you're listening to the podcast. Please check us out on YouTube, Hitting Killers with Tony Bruschi. You can comment on all of the cases we follow right there and join in that conversation. Please do so. We do greatly appreciate that. And press subscribe, again, wherever you're listening. If you're listening on the podcast, go check us out on YouTube and get there. If you're on the podcast or on YouTube, go check us out on the podcast so you can listen to all the content. Everything we put on YouTube, it is on the podcast as well. So you can listen anywhere you go. So do check that out. We do greatly appreciate it. And like I said, put your thoughts in the comments. There's a lot to break down here. I am quite surprised by the fact that she's rested. Will it stay that way? Why did she rest? Let's hear your thoughts.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.